Good evening, you all. K2 Romeo, India Whiskey here. My name is Dick.
Oh, come on.
And at this time, we begin the TICnet. For those who haven't heard the TICnet before, its major purpose is giving out a little bit of information about this fairly complicated topic we've gotten involved in called ham radio. And there's lots of different kinds of ham radio, 26 kinds that we can count. And FM 2-meter repeater ham radio you're listening to right now is just one of the 26 kinds. So if you get a little bit discouraged with that one, before giving up the hobby, try one of the other 25. A person signs into the TICnet by giving their call letters, their name, and a yes after that, which means you do have a question or a comment to the net. You need not sign in unless you really want to. If you don't have a question or a comment, after 24.8 years or something like that, we assume there are people out there listening. Mel, K2KEY, will probably have some really sexy emails that have been sent to him, which we'll be attempting to answer. So people get to us by way of either on the air, or if you don't have your license yet, or you're a little bit bashful, by way of email, you can also get to us. And then Paul, probably to WS2N, will be giving us the latest report on what's going on in space. And there's been a launch of the space shuttle and a soon link up that we'll probably be hearing about a lot more going on in space. So let's get started. Please give me your call letters and name, and I'm confirming yes at this time if you would like to sign in. K2RIW listening.
Into NBA.
In, no questions.
Okay, we got some stranger named Barry and another stranger named Rick. Rich, signing in. Anyone else?
WS2N. Paul, good evening, Dick.
We got Paul. Paul doubled with somebody. Who was the other person?
OQD.
Okay, Mr. OQD. I think that's Bob with his brand new set of call letters. Hard for me to remember already. Anyone else to sign in? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
KC2MDG. Steve, no question.
Okay, Steve with a no. One of the few ones. Okay, anyone else? Okay, let's start off with Barry. And Barry, tonight we're going to discuss anything except high power amplifiers, particularly 1296. What would you like to talk about? N2 moonbound. K2LAW, have us in front of you.
Okay, N2MV mobile. That's K2RW. And an A. Yes, I want to know if anybody has ever made a measurement to find out if there was even an infinitesimally small difference in the time or the speed of a radio signal from, let's say, you know, down in the broadcast band up into the light wave. Is there any difference at all in the speed, even minutely small? I got a reason for asking that question. It has something to do with the particle wave theory that I've been thinking about for the last hour or so. N2MV mobile.
Okay, that's a unusual question about physics there, Barry. And by the way, Barry and I, as you can tell, had an earlier, very brief conversation today about high-power amplifiers. Excuse me for a second. I thought that's what we're going to possibly talk about tonight. To my knowledge, Barry, everything electronic, that means a light wave, an ultraviolet wave, a cosmic ray, infrared, a millimeter, submillimeter, microwave, VHF, UHF, SHF, HF, low frequency, anything electronic, the rate at which the signal propagates is only a function of 1 over the dielectric constant of the medium, in other words, the speed of the medium. And I've never seen anything leading me to believe that one frequency propagates faster than another in a vacuum. Now, the confusing factor here is that, just take, for instance, optical materials, borosilicate glass or whatever, crown glass, lead-loaded glass. When it comes to the zillions of kinds of glass that they make lenses out of, a really smart guy will make a compound lens where the lens is not just one single piece of glass. It's two or three pieces of glass glued together. together various kinds of glands in order to correct for chromatic aberration. In other words, if you didn't do that, if you just made one single kind of glass, you made a magnifying glass, you would see red and blue tinges around all the sharp edges, because what's going on with glass, among other materials, is that its velocity of propagation, or 1 over its dielectric constant, or its index of refraction, three very similar words. The index of refraction of glass is a function of wavelength. So various kinds of glass go up and down in velocity of propagation of the wave going through them. And you can get down to the molecular level, at the crystalline level of the glass, and find out why it does that. So various materials will allow certain wavelengths to go faster than other wavelengths. And if you're smart enough to use that correctly, you make a compound lens, and you correct for chromatic aberration, you make a beautiful refractor telescope where you don't see red and blue tinges around the objects, the stars, and planets, and whatever you're taking a picture of. So an ordinary, simple refractor-type telescope made out of a non-compound lens would give you chromatic aberration. So various materials are wavelength-sensitive. Teflon is your and my favorite material when it comes to radio circuits, Barry. If I'm making a really high-quality printed circuit board, I'd like to be using glass Teflon, expensive stuff. And even Teflon is very constant, very close to constant, in its dielectric constant versus frequency, but it's not perfectly constant. Certain frequencies go through the Teflon a little bit faster than others. So this is the property of the material, the crystalline structure, in some cases, of the material. Whereas in a vacuum, a true, pure, broadband material, to my knowledge, essentially every single frequency goes at the same speed. Now, there's a slight variation of that. If you really get to the truly long-range QSOs, I'm talking about you and I are watching with our really great big telescope, we're looking at a quasar, a quasi-stellar object that's a zillion galaxies away, and the light that gets to us experiences a gravity gradient focusing. In other words, a really heavy galaxy between me and that star I'm looking at will bend the wave coming here, even though it's going through so-called empty free space, and therefore I get a focusing action, and I see certain objects much brighter and better focused than I should because it's an intermediate heavy object. So even empty space, so-called empty space, has a slight variation. And now you're getting into Einstein's relativity type stuff, whereas what's it now called? Space-time continuum type jazz. In other words, in the presence of heavy gravity, a light wave does move at a different speed. But somehow I don't think you're getting into that yet. So I guess you're going to have to give us a couple more words as to what you're really saying. I've given you what I think are a couple of ingredients of an answer. N2 Moonbound, H-U-L-I-W of the deck band.
Okay, yeah, well, I'm trying to come up with, you know, there's an argument here that first of all, it's free space. That's the first argument. I don't even care about the rest. Free space is the place that I would like to delve into at the moment. And when I say free space, I mean a place where there's virtually nothing. Now, you tell me that there is no such place because there's also some gravity floating around out there. So, and gravity is definitely having its effect on this wave coming in. It's bending it. It's doing all kinds of things to it. But my argument is, how on earth does this wave get there? Waves don't exist by themselves. They have to travel on something. That's what it means when you say a wave. It's a wave of something. A wave in something, or whatever. A wave of energy, but a wave of something. It can't just be a wave. So it's got to have a particle component to it. And I'm thinking, how in the world, when I bounce a signal off the moon or whatever I do, how is it getting there? There is no way for that wave to get there. It's not moving through anything, save a particle, if there is one. So I'm thinking that it's bringing its own baggage along. In other words, it's not a momentary conversion from a particle to a wave. It's not like that. It's possible. I think there might even be a way to measure that. It'd be very difficult to measure that, but I think there could be a way to measure that. If given enough distance, you might be able to measure that. But I'm thinking more like a transition that takes place between like current and voltage, where you have a smooth transition, and it is particle, it is wave, it is changing over time, but it's like current and voltage in a wire, kind of, like it's how you measure it and where you measure it as to whether what you say what it is, you know? And I'm also thinking that maybe the way it gets there, it has something to do with the time of transition. In other words, the wave front, how long it takes to change from particle to wave, would in fact be its progression forward. So it's sort of feeding on itself as it gets to this star. It doesn't need anything else. It's recreating its own path as it moves. RWN2MB.
Okay, I see where you're going with this, Barry. Barry, as you can tell, chose a vanity call into Mike Bravo because it really stands for Into Moonbounce. And Moonbounce is sort of the ultimate of all the 26 kinds of ham radio that really, in the past, before Joe Taylor came along and invented his very fancy modulation techniques where weaker signals can be interpreted in the noise, before that came along, Moonbounce really separated the men from the boys. It took a healthy 1,000 watts of power delivered to the antenna. It took an antenna of a 400 square foot of area, 29 dB of gain. It took a 1 dB noise figure front end in order to hear your echo reliably off the moon at 432 megacycles, 263 dB round trip air loss. And that's, in other words, how strong is the signal that you get back that you send out to the moon? You put one with 26.3 zeros after it, and that's the ratio of the power. To say that the signal coming back is weak is a drastic understatement. So that's why I say Moonbounce really separates the men from the boys. Now, Barry is troubled by the two-way path to the moon and back. I'm going more basic than that. Since 1971, on Apollo 15 and Apollo 16, one-way path bugged the hell out of me. I mean, Irwin and the other three astronauts, I'm having trouble with my brain remembering their names right now, on Apollo 15, set up a 10-watt transmitter on the moon, sent the signal from the moon to the Earth with a 10-foot dish or with a 6-foot dish, anyhow, set up on the lunar surface. I set up a 12-foot dish in Farmingdale, Long Island, out in front of Microwave Instruments Division of Airborne Instruments Laboratory, and with a low-noise preamp of a homebrew antenna. You can see in the August 1972 front cover issue of QST Magazine, August is the article about the antenna itself. I listen to astronaut audio. I know that 10-watt signal emitted from the moon had lots of local signal strength, E-field, voltage current, whatever, flowing through the feed horn of that dish. Between moon and Earth is nothing but the hardest vacuum in the world. Nothing is there. And I know that before the astronaut turned on that transmitter, nothing was in that space in between. They turned on the transmitter, nothing is that space in between. And they finished the transmission. 5 hours worth of tape recordings on my part downrange, 15 hours on Apollo 16. They turned off the transmitter and nothing was there. In other words, not a single electron left that antenna on the moon and came through that hard vacuum of space between moon and Earth and came down to my little antenna in Farmingdale. Barry and I have lived with radio all of our lives. We know how to calculate it. You tell me how much antenna gain you're using, how many watts you're transmitting. You tell me how many miles there are between the transmitting antenna and the receiving antenna. You tell me something about the medium in between, particularly the three space. You tell me something about the noise figure of your front end of your receiver and something about the receiver's bandwidth and what kind of modulation is being used. And Barry and I can make a pretty good prediction with a fraction of a dB as to how strong that signal-to-noise ratio is going to be of that audio, whatever, coming out of that loudspeaker. We've got experiential evidence. We know how to calculate it. And yet he and I are sitting here saying, what the hell happened? What moved? Barry is now saying that the particle goes over to a wave and the wave goes over to a particle. That's a theory. Many other people have said that it's the particle-wave duality that when you're up to super high frequencies like gamma rays, X-rays, and cosmic rays, the wave behaves more like a particle. When you're way down at radio frequencies, where we operate, it behaves 99.99% like a wave, not like a particle. So whether it's a particle, whether it's a wave, the answer is yes. Does it have more particle qualities up at the super high frequencies? Yes. Does it have more wave-like properties at the low frequencies? Yes. But what is it? And so some really smart people, Barry, have sat and come and we talked about it's got to go through something. So you call it the phlogiston. You call it the ether. You call it the cislunar space. You give it any name you want. It's like your physician saying you've got a virus. He's given it a name. It doesn't mean he knows what it is. It's some kind of an unknown. But he's given it a name. He's giving you a prescription to go away and you think you're happy. And so the radio people, the guys down at the basic level of physics, don't really know what a radio wave is. Well, let's go one step earlier than that, Barry. That is, the radio wave is an electromagnetic wave. It's got E field and it's got H field. It's got magnetism and it's got the voltage to it. You can't yet explain what the heck is magnetism. I put two north poles of a magnet close together and they repel each other. I put a north and a south together, they attract each other. What in the world is in between? We call it Weber's per square meter and lines and Oersted. We got all kinds of fancy words describing the magnitude and the quantization of magnetism. Nobody's got a good explanation for what is magnetism. It also propagates through a hard vacuum. It propagates through dielectric materials. It propagates very nicely through non-magnetic materials. But what is magnetism? That's one step more basic than the radio wave. I'm just talking about the magnetism itself. And how about electrostatic attraction and electrostatic repulsion? That again propagates through a vacuum. And it doesn't go away just because you've increased the distance. It just gets weaker by the inverse square law. So the more basic components that make up an electromagnetic wave, they can't be explained. And gravity can't be explained. So there's a lot more science study required here. I mean, a naive person would say, gee, we've discovered everything. I've born too late. I'm not going to get a chance to make any great breakthroughs in science or medicine or whatever. There's a lot more unknown than there is known. So even magnetism, gravity, and electrostatic attraction and repulsion at the molecular and submolecular level, at the microscopic and submicroscopic level, I say right now cannot be explained, Barry. And so I think you can see the conundrum we're in here. You're speculating that that wave flips back and forth between particle and wave. I don't accept that, but I can't say you're wrong. And two moon bounce, K2RIW in the group.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not exactly saying that it changes state. I would say that it's a continual change of state, like voltage and current. It's just where you measure it that it appears to be one or the other, or how you measure it at the moment, how you're making the measurement, so to speak. But anyway, I think it appears to me that all of these things have a limit to their speed. And I think in the case of magnetism, you could measure it. If you had a really strong magnet and you put something really far away from it, I think as soon as you turn the magnet on, you would find that the attraction to the distant object would take place at about 186,000 miles a second. I don't know if anybody's ever made that particular measurement with magnetism, but I would argue that it's probably going to come up to be the same as the speed of radio, the speed of light. And I'm wondering if anybody has ever successfully made a measurement to gravity. I know that's a tough one to turn on and off, but sometimes you could be affected by another gravity or something which could show you the effects. Who knows? But if they all have the same speed, what is the limiting factor? And with that, I will put this particle to rest. That was a pun. H-Y-W-N-2-M-B.
Okay, when it comes to the speed of turning on and off magnetism, left-handedly, we've been doing that experiment, Barry, whenever you send a radio wave. If you go to the right website, and I can give you a few websites, they will show you an animation, a computer-generated animation of what a radio wave sort of looks like as it propagates through space. And they usually will show a horizontally polarized wave, where with a isometric graphic, you're seeing the horizontally polarized sine wave propagating in space. It looks like a snake, but it moves along in the Z direction. Perpendicular to that, you see the H field wave, the magnetic wave. It's a sine wave going up and down, and the E field wave is a sine wave going back and forth, and they both propagate through space together. So you could say that the individual plus and minus magnetism chunk of that wave are propagating at the speed of light. So it's a kind of a turn on and turn off. Now, a significant percentage, maybe it's as much as 20%, of the respected textbooks, a significant percentage of the websites you can go to, get it wrong. If I choose one particular point in space, and I stop time, and I look at that waveform, if I've chosen a point in space where the E field is maximum, that's the one that's going left and right, at that exact same point in space, at that exact same instant of time, the H field wave, the one that's going up and down, magnetic field, is also at its maximum. In other words, the E field and the H field are at maximum at the exact same instant of time. A little bit further down in time, or a little bit further along the Z-axis, they both go to absolute zero, and another quarter wave further along in time, or further along in distance, they both go to the negative maximum. So an electromagnetic wave is a wave where at each instant of time, there is an exact proportion between the magnetic field and the E field, related by the impedance, 377 ohms, very similar to what happens if you and I are doing an Ohm's law experiment. You tell me how many volts you put across the resistor, you tell me how many ohms the resistor has, and I'll tell you how much current is flowing through the resistor, Ohm's law. And by the exact same equivalent, I can say space is a volumetric resistor, which obeys the law of 377 ohms. That's a round off, by the way. It's really 120 pi, 376.99 something. We round it off to 377 ohms. But Mother Nature, whoever she is, designed free space as a volumetric resistor that obeys this law of 377 ohms. And you can arrive at that number by dividing the magnetic field versus the electrostatic field, and what is the ratio between the two. There's lots of ways you can get there. And why in the world was it designed that way? And then is that ratio between the two that gives it the impedance? It's that ratio or product that gives you the speed of light of 186 or 3, very, very close to 3 times 10 to the 8 meters per second. So we got a lot of quantitative knowledge. We got a lot of experience of doing this, but we don't really know what it is. So E field and H field, you can turn them on and off very nicely by way of transverse electromagnetic wave, or you can really do it by putting some kind of a shutter mechanism. And you can easily build a shutter mechanism for an E field, and you can build a shutter mechanism for an H field. Very similar to what Michelson did with a shutter mechanism with candles in a reflector. He had a shutter mechanism and a reflector on the other mountain. And by operating the shutter mechanism faster and faster until he got an eclipse. In other words, the light that he's sending out took a certain amount of time to go from one mountain to the other mountain, reflect off the mirror, and come back. And if that was long enough compared to the period of time that he was opening and closing the shutter, it was a rotary shutter mechanism. And if he turns the rotary shutter mechanism at just the right rate, all of a sudden the whole system seems to wink out because he's now getting a pulse back of light that happens to arrive because of the void time when the shutter is closed again. And all of a sudden, you don't see any light. And then you go to harmonics at that speed, and you start seeing it again. So by various techniques like this, you can literally measure what is the speed of light in the air that's between the two mountains where you're doing the experiment. That's how it was done in the very beginning. And another technique that was used was that some Einsteinian-type guy recognized the fact that when you watch Io, Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto, the three Galileo-like moons going around Jupiter, you know that because Jupiter's orbit is different than ours, at certain times of the year, our year, not Jupiter year, we're closer and further away from Jupiter, and if you carefully time the fact that Io goes around the planet once every 2 days, roughly Earth once every 2 Earth days, Io, the inner moon of Jupiter, goes all the way around the planet. And if you carefully study the timing, you realize that in our winter versus our summer, as far as Jupiter is concerned, the timing seems to be ahead or behind. And you soon realize that it's cyclic, it's repetitive, and hey, you're really measuring the speed of light. When you do that measurement, and you're doing it on an Earth to Jupiter distance, which is probably something like 9 or 10 astronomical units, a great big chunk of distance, one astronomical unit, distance between Earth and Sun, 93 million miles. That's really down the road a piece. So there's lots of ways you can do the experiment, and you keep coming up with the same answer, and you get more and more decimal places. I think we've now got the speed of light pinned down to about 8 or 9 decimal places, which is good enough for the time being. That just tells you how we got here from there, from my point of view, Barry. Not the slightest hint of an answer of what is the medium it's traveling through. And yes, it's a wave. That's a great word we give it to. It's a signal. It's got power. It's got energy, as I should say. We can measure the amount of energy. We can measure the inverse square law, the rate at which the energy falls off. You can measure all kinds of things. But what is it, and how the heck does it propagate through nothing? Not one single electron flows. This wave, whatever it is, works great stuff. Here we are in the middle of radio, using it, enjoying it. We at the really bedrock level. We don't know what it is. And I think that conundrum is going to exist for a long time to come, Barry. I don't think there's a simple answer to this one. When we finally figure out what magnetism is, what electrostatic attraction and repulsion is, and what gravity is, boy, we're going to be a lot smarter. By the time we get that all figured out, I think we're going to be able to make levitation-like machines, and we'll be able to make our flying saucer float over the ground very nicely. So that's something to look forward to. I know that ain't an answer. I'm going to turn it over to Barry, drag your feet a little bit in case somebody else wants to put their 2 cents worth into this crazy discussion. And two, Moonbath, a little delay, KQIW in the tech man.
KQKEY.
Bell recognized? Anyone else?
I'm going to sign out for a few minutes, and I'll be back. So if you look for me, I won't be here for about 10 minutes in 2MB. And I'll be right back after that, guys.
Okay, Barry. We'll try to hold the fort. You got it, Mel. Hey, Mel, Barry and Dick are having a great deal of trouble explaining this one. Why don't you tell us what the hell's really happening here, Mel?
Okay, this is KQKEY. Well, let's take, for instance, this abnormal thing in space called a black hole. They have a special name for it. What's the name? It starts with an A, Dick.
Some people call it an anomaly. Some people call it a singularity. And by the way, when energy is emitted, whenever something falls into a black hole, it gets accelerated to the speed of light. It runs into a whole lot of other particles. It goes down there, falls down that hole with a curved path. Everything with a curved path is giving out energy. So the amount of energy that is given off by a chunk of matter that falls into a black hole is significantly more efficient than if you and I had nuclear fusion as a power source. So, yeah, you're never going to see this stuff again once it falls into a black hole, that anomaly. But my goodness, does it go out with a bang, with a screaming energy burst as it does that. Back to Mel.
That black hole, the anomaly, black hole. Is it true they said that light, this gravitational pull is so great that light cannot escape from its dick over?
Absolutely. Everything that has gravity to it has an escape velocity. The Earth has a certain amount of gravity to it, and it's got a certain radius or diameter. And so if you were shooting bullets straight up in the air, and you kept shooting the bullets faster and faster and faster, most of the bullets would go up a certain distance, turn around, and come back down and strike the ground. It's like shooting an arrow in the air or shooting a bullet in the air. And by the way, don't ever shoot a gun in the air, because the bullet's going to come down somewhere, and except for wind resistance, it's going to come down about as fast as it went up, and it could create some injury to somebody. But if you shoot those bullets faster and faster, you suddenly find out that around 7 miles per second of velocity, the bullet goes up so high, so far away, that it never gets a chance to turn around. As it gets up there higher and higher, by inverse square law, as it gets further and further away from the mass center of the Earth, it experiences less and less gravity, So if you've got enough velocity left, when you get up to a pretty high altitude, where the gravity is starting to get weaker, you can keep on going. So at 7 miles per second, you've got escape velocity from the Earth. You go to that speed, and you ain't never coming back. So for each planet, has a different flight and a different amount of gravity, they all have a different escape velocity. You take something as heavy as the black hole, and the escape velocity is now a velocity that is so high, it's beyond the speed of light. Therefore, nothing can get back out of there unless it can travel faster than the speed of light. Right now, we don't know of anything that can move faster than the speed of light. So it's called the black hole. You just see nothing in that chunk of space, because anything that goes in there can't get back out, and the light even can't get back out because it don't move fast enough to exceed the escape velocity. And maybe on the next transmission, I'll give you a couple more words again on the subject of gamma ray bursts and why they're so significant and why it's related to what you're asking. But back to you, Mel. H-U-K-U-I, H-U-L-I-W.
Okay, so now once light, say, enters the black hole, it goes in and cannot come out or stuck there because there's tremendous cold. If I could transmit a signal into a black hole, well, does my radio signal also go in there and get stuck over?
I think the answer is absolutely yes. In other words, you and I could be a good distance apart from each other, and I'm sending a radio signal to you, you receive it, and you interpret the message and then send the radio signal back to me. And if you and I position ourselves in such a way that the black hole, let's say midway between us, and by some means we protect ourselves from this down thing because you have to be careful you don't fall into it. So you and I are both in orbit around this black hole, but you're on the back side of the black hole and I'm on the front side. And I try sending you a radio signal. It ain't going to get there. Because of everything coming near the black hole, experiences the warping of space because of the strong gravity field nearby, everything gets curved into that black hole, including our radio signal. So even if I aim the radio signal 10 degrees to the right of the black hole or 10 degrees to the left of the black hole or 10 degrees above or below, that radio signal is going to be curved through that warping of space into the black hole. It goes in there and never comes out. So you on the back side, you ain't going to hear me. So interesting experiment if we did that. You got it, Mel.
Okay. Can't transmit through it. Let me ask you something. This huge gravity hole that's there. As we approach the black hole, do we start in at a slow rate and then speed up there?
Absolutely. If there isn't something locally, like if you and I right now are in our own sphere of gravity influence around the Earth, so your house in Manhattan Beach and my house in Huntington are both being sucked down to the Earth by local gravity, and I'm part of that house, I'm being sucked down, so I'm alongside of something that's locally controlled. In theory, if you and I were completely floating free in space, away from everything, and if a couple of astronomical units of distance away from us, there was a black hole, you and I would slowly accelerate toward that black hole. There's no choice. Unless something else locally is controlling you, like your house, your Earth, and the solar system, you would drift toward the black hole, and everything that approaches the black hole, no matter where it starts, no matter how slow it starts, or no matter how fast it starts, as it drifts, as it gets sucked into that black hole because of such a strong gravity, it will, at the event horizon of the black hole, will be accelerating faster and faster, and at that event horizon, you will be exactly at the speed of light. At the last instant that you scream bloody blue murder and you get sucked into that black hole, you will be moving at the speed of light and emitting energy like you wouldn't believe. You got it, Mel.
Okay, but is this gravitational pull so huge there, and it sucks in, why doesn't it go faster? If it's holding light in there, that light cannot escape. Wouldn't it have to be light be traveling faster than the normal speed of light to be trapped in there, Dick?
Nope. Anything that falls inside of that event horizon of that black hole, and by the way, it takes an amount of mass minimum of roughly 3 solar masses to make a black hole. and there are black holes out there that are millions and billions of solar masses in magnitude. And can you imagine a pair of those black holes that decide to drift together and envelop each other? That's one of the explanations for what is a gamma ray burst. And thank goodness almost all the gamma ray bursts occur a zillion galaxies away from us, a very long distance. If a gamma ray burst occurs within 20 light years of where you and I live, it's game over. Everything gets fried. Because what is a gamma ray burst? And they got all kinds of theories. A pair of black holes coming together, a black hole and a white dwarf, a black hole and a neutron star. Anyhow, two very massive objects coming together is the best explanation you got so far as to what is a gamma ray burst. But how much energy is a gamma ray burst? It's a relatively simple calculation. If I made a careful measurement by taking 1 square meter of black material, put it in my backyard on a sunny day, and measure how much sunlight hits it, it's around 1,300 watts per square meter. That's the solar constant at this distance. And by inverse square law, you know, the sun is 93 million miles away, you can actually figure out how much energy is coming out of the sun. And I forget the exact number, but it's something like 10 to the 26th watt is coming out of the sun. And the sun has roughly a lifetime of 10 billion years, 10 to the 10 years. So you put it all together, and you figure out how many watts per second, which is a joule, how much power is coming out now, assuming it's constant, that's going to do it for 10 billion years. You get 10 to the 43 joules of energy that comes out of the sun in its 10 billion year lifetime. 10 to the 43 power joule. 10 with a 43 as a superscript. That's how much power comes out of the sun, and it takes 10 billion years, and billion years to do it. A gamma ray burst is that amount of energy not occurring in 10 billion years, occurring in 1 second. Is that a big bang? Wow. That's what a gamma ray burst is. You put the right kind of detector in space, and you will see at least one gamma ray burst somewhere in space. I forget what the number is. I think it's once per month or so. Somewhere in space, these things are going on continuously. And boy, they're potent and very hard to explain. And they could very well be the source of cosmic rays. And cosmic rays, you're seeing cosmic rays every time you see a lightning bolt. That zigzagging of a lightning bolt is caused by the local cosmic rays creating an ionized path, and the voltage of that lightning bolt jumps along that ionized path, and that's why the zigzag of a lightning bolt. So, isn't that funny the way it all ties together? Gamma ray burst probably is one of the origins of cosmic rays. Cosmic rays hit the Earth, hit the atmosphere, and create all these ionized paths. And the lightning follows those ionized paths and gives you the zigzag, and you can see it visually as to what's going on. I know I've drifted off subject, but it's fun type stuff that I've been studying lately. You've got to know.
Hey, what I was trying to get at, that in other words, what happens to light waves as they enter a black hole, they will be subject to the radio wave, will get the same treatment. Am I correct in saying plain English that a radio wave and a light wave going into a black hole winds up in the same situation? Am I correct, over?
I think the answer is yes. Because when you call it a light wave or you call it a radio wave, all you've done is to shift the frequency. If I could grab that dial on your ideal radio set, keep cranking it to higher and higher numbers, and I go through VHF, UHF, SHF, X-band, KU-band, millimeter wave, submillimeter wave, very far infrared, near infrared, and eventually I hit optical, and eventually I hit stuff. I keep going, I hit the ultraviolet, and far ultraviolet, and X-ray, and gamma ray, and then eventually cosmic ray. All of those various kinds of signal and wave are just a difference in frequency, or if you want to think the other way, a difference in wavelength. So it's the exact same electromagnetic spectrum. We're just talking about what frequency on the dial where it appears. Mel, go ahead.
Okay, now, that's where I'm trying to get at now. That's why I wanted to bring up the black hole and the radio waves and the light waves going in there. If before we transmitted the first radio signal, I would have said to you that we're definitely going to be able to send a radio signal across space. Otherwise, we wouldn't see light there.
Absolutely. So in other words, any star that you see has sent a light wave to you a billion years ago, and it's just getting here now. And in theory, you could send a light wave back if you had a really powerful flashlight, and same number of billion years again, they, on that solar system, would see the light from you. So it works in both directions, and we're sort of getting into reciprocity here. But go ahead, Mel.
Okay, so the light wave could travel through space, one way, back and forth, or whatever you want to call it. Why shouldn't light, what's the big mystery, whatever light wave travels through space, through whatever medium, I guess the radio wave, like you say, is just a different frequency, rides the same situation, the same track over.
Absolutely. So I'm wondering now, I guess a lot of people think that an infrared signal, an ultraviolet signal, an optical signal, a millimeter wave signal, a microwave signal, an HF, a VHF, they'd like to think that somehow these are all different kinds of signals. It's really the exact same kinds of signal, just how high is the frequency. The middle of the optical frequency region that you're looking at that front dial of your transmitter with right now is very similar to roughly 550 megacycles, except that it's 1 million times higher in frequency. So if I take 550 megacycles, multiply by a million times, I'm now in the middle of the optical frequency region. You got it, Mel. That last thought was so powerful, it quieted him down for a minute.
Yeah, because if we see light traveling through space, whatever medium light is used to travel, like you say, from the stars or whatever, that same medium, whatever that is, I don't know, what would you call it? I should say something, there's something there. Whatever that medium is, that's what radio waves most likely use in the same medium of their over.
It has no choice, no. Obvious by the fact that the sunlight, which is a kind of optical, well, the sun really goes, I could call it DC to light, it goes DC to cosmic rays. The sun is a very broadband signal source. And to a earthbound observer, it looks like a nearly point source that's got half a degree of beam width to it. So that signal from the sun and all that energy that runs our solar cells and creates our weather and keeps the earth warm and gives us lots of energy to grow the plants that allow us to get the hydrocarbons that comes in, turns into oil, and allows us to run our automobiles and so on. All of the energy from the sun is propagating through the hard vacuum of space between sun and earth. There's very little there. Not absolutely nothing, but it's so close to nothing it doesn't matter. But when that signal from the sun, most of the spectrum from the sun, is reasonably transparent when it goes through the atmosphere. You add a zillion air molecules to each cubic meter, and the radio wave, the optical wave, has very little trouble going through that. So adding certain substances like air and glass and the quartz and a whole bunch of other substances, the signal will travel at a slightly different rate through each one of those substances, depending on what's called the index of refraction, or the dielectric constant, or the velocity of propagation through that medium. Three different words that really are expressing the exact same phenomenon. So when that signal goes into a more dense phenomenon, air is a little bit more dense than vacuum, water is a little bit more dense than air, glass is a little bit more dense than that, quartz may be a little bit more dense than that, but and each time you go to a more dense material, the wave can slow down a little bit, but it propagates through there very nicely. So what you and I call substance that we add in between that space that the signal has to go through, it creates a little bit of slowdown, but most of the energy will go through it. So the substance is not required for the propagation. It looks like hard vacuum, which is the lack of all substance, the signal goes through there very nicely. That's the part that's giving us trouble. We can sort of see how a signal is going to bounce between the molecules of a fluid, like glass, water in the glass, and we can sort of see how a signal might bounce across all of those molecules and get from here to there. But what the heck is the signal bouncing against in the case of a hard vacuum? That's the part that's giving us all a lot of trouble as I see it now. No simple explanation for this one. Come up with a good explanation. Come up with a way of bottling it. You got a lot of money. You got it, Mel.
Oh, I think whatever light is grabbing, whatever is the medium that light is using to get, like you say, from the source in here, I guess the radio waves is using the same medium being that you consider the different wavelengths. So however we see light from the source, if we can see the light from the source, there's no reason why we can't send a signal there, Dick, over.
Absolutely. The exact same electromagnetic spectrum. All we're talking about is higher and lower frequencies of the signal that we're either observing or creating or sending. You got it, Mel.
So that's what I'm saying. If light can do it, then radio waves should be able to do it. Whatever light gets, whatever affects light, like you say, a black hole and all, light gets stuck in a black hole, instead of radio waves want to get stuck in a black hole. So whatever medium light is using, I guess the radio wave rides on the same medium. What it is in between is most likely, I don't know. I don't know what we call a vacuum. What's supposedly a vacuum is nothing. It's empty, it's devoid, but there must be some kind of dust particle of some sort that's invisible, we can't measure, or we have no idea what it is. And it's there because otherwise I guess we would look up at the sky and we'd see black stick over.
Well, I just want to interject something here. Neutron waves, how do they figure into all this?
Okay, let's go back. Before we get to neutron waves, the sky is not black, Mel, because air is there. The air, nice clear air, makes the sky look blue. You climb a mountain like I did in the Flint Rock area of Switzerland when I went skiing there 1 year, and you get up on a 10,000-foot high mountain, and the sky doesn't look blue anymore. It looks a very deep blue, and if I could slowly climb to higher and higher, if I had the stamina to climb Mount Everest, the sky would look nearly black. If an astronaut's looking out the window of his space shuttle as it's going through the atmosphere, he'd watch the sky slowly turn from blue to absolute perfect black. Therefore, it's only the air of our clear atmosphere that makes the sky look blue, and why does it do that? And that is because when all of the sunlight, which is a very broad spectrum, from very low frequencies to very high frequencies, way beyond far infrared on the low frequency end, way beyond ultraviolet, far ultraviolet on the high frequency end, the sun is putting out all of those frequencies. It's a white light source. And the word white light has got a very specific meaning to a physics-oriented person. Very broadband, almost equal power, not quite, but you know what I mean. So when that white light hits the air in our atmosphere, the size of the air molecules scatters some of that light. The size of the air molecules are smaller than the average optical wavelength that your eye operates on. So therefore, the scattering of the air molecules favors the higher frequencies. The higher frequencies scatter more efficiently off the air molecules than the lower frequencies. The higher frequencies are the ones toward blue and ultraviolet. So it's the blue scattering of the air that makes the sky look blue. Remove the air and the sky is black. So if you're looking at scattering of white light by the air molecules, that's what turns the sky blue. Now, neutrons, you get positrons and neutrons in the nucleus of every atom, almost every atom. You've got was it the neutron you're talking about, Barry? Or you're talking about, I can't think of the other name of the particle that has no mass to it. Back to you, Barry. Which one are you asking about?
I got it. Like I had to run back to the kitchen. I was, in fact, talking about neutrons. I wanted to know that they seem to be unaffected by matter. You know, they seem to go through the Earth very nicely. And if that's the case, do they also have the same speed as light waves? Are they restricted by that same speed level? Over.
Oh, no. Yeah, we're confusing the positive particles, the negative particles, and the neutral particles. Okay, the neutron waves, I think the neutron waves travel at the speed of light. If someone has had a comment on that one?
WS, go on.
Go ahead, Paul. Hey, Paul, straighten us out on this one. We're looking pretty far afield here.
Oh, don't look at me. Barry means the neutrinos. The neutrons have a little trouble getting through the Earth. The neutrinos go flying right through the Earth like the Earth wasn't even there. Once in a while, they could stop one of these gigantic mines that they dig down, and fill it up with different liquids. One time they did with freons, and a little detector will go off when it's interfered with a little piece of neutrino. But these neutrinos, you've got like, I don't know, billions of them going through you right now, every second, and not only from this direction of the Earth, but, you know, from China coming right through the Earth and coming up right through your feet. So there's a lot of weird things out there. And as far as the electromagnetic field goes, I think it's kind of like, you know, if you throw a ball up in the air and you get, you know, you get to that zero point, where it's so-called weightless, is that ball still being pulled at 32 feet per second per second? And the answer is yes, even though it looks like it's standing still. It's got energy. If it wasn't, 3 seconds from now, it would still be in that same location. So I think the electromagnetic field kind of does the same thing. You never really, you know, you might be hitting what you call a zero point, but it's still got a lot of wattage behind it from when it left the transmitter or left the sun. Still got power behind it. No matter what part of a second you go down to, it never stops. It's constantly in motion. And what is it, Maxwell? He's the one with first you have the capacitance and then the inductance and back and forth, and one gives way to the other. So as long as you have the electromagnetic force and the magnetic force there, you're interacting with one another, one thing going up and the other going down, and then vice versa. And then next split second, it's constantly in motion. And what's amazing is, you know, you can make a transmission to Mars or to Jupiter, or, you know, you make a transmission up to the rovers on Mars, and you shut your transmitter down here, which they do after the transmission is made, and the software gets loaded up. It might be 10, 20 minutes later. Meanwhile, there's no more transmitting down here. These waves are flying all by themselves, interacting with itself. I think Barry's closer to being right. Carrying his own baggage with him. That's pretty good way of...